this week's program, a conversation with Kimmel Center President Anne Ewers. She's now been at the helm of Philadelphia's Regional Performing Arts Center since July. Susan Lewis visits Gershwin to Gillespie, Portraits in American Music at the Michener Museum in New Hope. We speak with Carlos Basualdo, curator of notations, Kiefer Polker Richter, an exhibition of works by three post-war German artists at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And in our continuing series on what it takes to bring theatre to life, Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of the dramaturg. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Prior to coming to Philadelphia, Anne Ewers was president and chief executive officer of Utah Symphony and Opera, the two performing arts organizations having merged in July 2002. During her tenure in Salt Lake City, Ewers doubled the organization's endowment from $18 to $36 million and turned a structural deficit of $1.8 million into a $360,000 surplus. Before Utah, she was general manager of the Boston Lyric Opera, and before that, an assistant stage director at San Francisco Opera. Ewers has had a virtually concert-free summer to become familiar with her new role as president and chief executive officer of the Kimmel, and when we met earlier this week, she told me how she had spent her first months.
I've spent the last 2 months meeting with every single board member, one-on-one. 35. I have about 10 more to go. And in those conversations, people are very candid, very passionate, explaining and telling me some of their concerns, some of their issues, things that we need to improve on, things that they love. It's been absolutely revelatory. And that has been very exciting for me. Not that I didn't expect a good board, but when you see the expertise around this table and the potential of the Kimmel is amazing. I think what we have to realize is this is only 5 years old. And the first number of years were it was about construction and then startup. And now we're moving into a whole new phase. And the organization is really poised to take off. And I think there's so much that we can do, but it's important to recognize what's been done.
Your predecessor had both the advantage of having a new facility and all the novelty and all the interest that there is in something new, and I guess the disadvantage of having to deal with construction debt and water leaking through ceilings and all of the various teething problems that a new building such as this has. How do you now go about keeping the level of interest both in the donor community and in the audience at the level that it was at for those first 5 years?
Well, I think a couple of things. We are meant to be a destination location. That's one of the main missions of the Kimmel Center. And you can't become that overnight. So I think it's now our opportunity to reach out to a more broad, a more diverse audience. I think there is a real chance to do some things that you couldn't do in the first 5 years. I mean, look at Lincoln Center or Kennedy Center. Those things didn't happen overnight. And so we've got that chance now to keep that building and that growth and that excitement going forward. I mean, if you look at just the difference between the previous year and last year, 21% increase in audience. That's pretty good. And already we're seeing 1 million people come through that door. So it's now between ourselves, you know, the Kimmel Center itself and, of course, the Academy of Music. And so I think we can build on that. You're absolutely right. It's a challenge. It's a challenge to find new things that will entice people. I think there's a whole demographic that we're not serving as well as we might, the 20s, 30s, 40-year-olds. I think that artistically we can broaden from what we currently do. We do some amazing things, and the breadth is massive. But if you really are serving an entire community, you need to be able to have offerings that relate to every aspect of that community. I think also one of my primary goals right from the get-go is to get rid of the construction overage. Anybody who's involved in construction knows that an overage is expected. So a 12% overage is understandable. However, we now need to finish handling that $30 million shortfall from the construction, and I think that needs to be done swiftly, and that I think also will re-engage donors in their excitement. It will help people realize that we are on strong footing and moving forward. So I think that will do more than probably anything else to re-engage and involve donors.
Much was made when you came here of your fundraising ability and your previous positions. Something that wasn't focused so much on was, and everybody talks about how important education is for any institution of this kind, very little was made of just how expansive the educational programs you were running in Utah were. What are your ambitions here? Because the Kimmel's a bigger place, a bigger organization, but is doing less than you were doing in Utah.
Yes. And I think, again, it's the youthfulness of the Kimmel. I mean, Utah Opera, before the merger, was 25 years old and had started the educational programs almost with the inception of the company. The Utah Symphony was over 50 years old and had been doing education for many years.
But they were doing more than much bigger organizations. You were doing, in terms of numbers, you were doing more, I think, I read somewhere,
more than San Francisco. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think there's much to be done here. And the important piece is the partnership and connection with the resident companies. We want to make sure that anything that we do with the Kimmel works in partnership with what the eight residents are doing. And they're doing some wonderful educational things. So the educational pieces that we want to do are things that are not competing or replicating what's already being done. I think there is huge potential in the educational arena. What's interesting, and I'll share my thinking on all of this, and it ties both to education and, frankly, to everything that we look forward to. I indicated that in the first 60 days of my tenure, I would make no main decisions, that I would use this as a time of listening and learning. And as I commented about meeting with every board member, I'm also meeting with clusters of eight staff members until we get through the entire staff of 110. We just did it this morning. We have a CEO breakfast. And I ask each person to share their most creative idea that they've ever had about the Kimmel Center. It is amazing what people are coming forward with. What's important in all of this, as I listen to board, as I listen to staff, as I listen to members in the community, everyone has to embrace what it is we're about and what we're doing. For somebody to come in and dictate off the top has no long-term effect, because if people don't get excited, don't bring the ideas to the table, don't feel like they're empowered and a part of it, it means nothing. So what we talk about now are some great ideas, and our next step as a group is to decide, okay, which of these ideas do we want to bring forward? What is the time frame? Do we do this one now? Do we do this in 2 years? And so when I talk about education, it will need to be what we as a group, all of the ideas that we brought forward and how we'd like to splay that out. But certainly there's room for much growth, and I think everyone around the table is excited about that.
There have been over the years many occasions when people have commented about what the Kimmel is not doing in terms of making it accessible during the day and having people come in and use the building, not just when there are performances on. Are there other, well, first of all, is that something that you would like to see more of? And are there other things that you noticed the minute you got in the door and said, well, that's not right, or we're going to change that pretty quickly?
You know, of all my conversations, the hottest topic is exactly what you've just described. We're meant to be a destination location. Why aren't we having more daytime activity? Why is this place not booming? And you know what I love about the fact of our location? Kenny Gamble, one of our wonderful board members, his godmother used to run the Paradise Lounge on this site. The place was streaming with people. And, you know, Diana Ross would record across the street and come over for dinner and what have you. So the energy, as I like to say, on this location is perfect for that kind of excitement and that kind of presence and involvement. And I do think that we can get there. The ideas that people have come up with, all the way from what kind of activities can we have to how do we do something with signage, how do we do something with reorganizing what's going on in the lobby to make it more welcoming. The ideas are terrific. And the question is, okay, which do we do first, and how do we do this so we get the largest result for the action?
President and Chief Executive Officer of the Kimmel Center, Anne Ewers. The Kimmel opens its new season next Sunday, September 16th, with a performance by Johnny Mathis.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Most artists are known through their work, painters through their brushstrokes, writers by their words, and composers and musicians through their songs and melodies. But sometimes one art form can shed light on another. An exhibition now at the Michener Museum's New Hope location was created to honour the two passions of George Eastman, the name behind both the Eastman Kodak Company and the Eastman School of Music. It tells a story of American music through photographs, but not just any photographs, as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports.
Can a photograph sing? The traveling exhibition Gershwin to Gillespie, Portraits in American Music, begins with the premise that photography has something to say about music, or at least those who create and perform it. Conversely, a great musician can infuse a photograph with a certain kind of energy. It was this collaboration between famous musicians and equally accomplished photographers that curator Olivia Mattis was after.
I didn't want someone taking a picture of some star. I really wanted to see the photographers and the musicians on equal footing so that the images would then become an amazing creative dialogue with energy coming out of the image.
Because capturing this creative dialogue drove the collecting, the show documents musical history, but not in a comprehensive way.
I wanted a balance between different genres of music, but I was really guided by the images themselves, and then I put those images where they belonged.
Mattis put each work in a category. Samuel Barber and Leonard Bernstein are in Great American Composers, Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk in Legends of American Jazz. People like Frank Sinatra, Bob Dylan, and Cole Porter are in Icons of American Pop.
And then there's a fourth category called Champions of American Music. And these were basically performers who didn't fit into these other categories. For example, Paul Robeson, the great bass baritone, Marian Anderson, the great contralto, who was also a civil rights pioneer. These were examples of champions of American music.
The 50 photographs span nearly a century, from a 1915 gelatin silver print of John Philip Sousa by Philadelphia portrait photographer Elias Goldensky, to a 2005 portrait of contemporary blues and rock singer Bonnie Raitt by Jeff Dunas. Many of the images are the work of a handful of acclaimed photographers, each of whom had a significant portfolio of musical subjects. Naomi Savage, niece of Man Ray, had made a project in the late 1940s of photographing composers. Philippe Halsman was a staff photographer for Life magazine, as was Annie Leibovitz at Rolling Stone. Art Kane's famous photograph called A Great Day in Harlem turned his career from art direction to photography. Herman Leonard first made a name for himself photographing jazz musicians in the 1940s. He says he'd frequent the clubs, take pictures, and use them to introduce himself.
Photographs were not so prevalent. So when I went in into a club and I did a set, and then I rushed back and I gave them prints, they were very grateful. And then I became welcomed to the set, whereas normally they did not like strange photographers hanging around, which I fully understand, because strange photographers can really be a pain in the neck.
Each photographer had his own approach, says curator Olivia Mattis. Most of Philippe Halsman's photographs were taken in the studio, where he might ask musicians to perform.
Louis Armstrong, Marian Anderson, he would try to provoke that person or get something out of their soul. The other Philippe Halsman one was the Joan Baez, where he gets her to shed a tear just by putting her music on the record player.
In contrast, Art Kane did what he called environmental portraits to convey what his subjects meant in American culture. One example is his photo of Sonny and Cher.
He wanted to portray something about California youth culture of the 1960s. So he had them both jump into their swimming pool, and he photographed them fully clothed at the bottom of their pool.
A jazz lover, Herman Leonard was eager to capture the atmosphere in which this uniquely American art form was created. Duke Ellington in a beam of light at the piano. Sonny Stitt with smoke curling like a musical genie around his saxophone. Backstage shots, like those of Billie Holiday and Lena Horne, which Leonard came to enjoy more than those taken in performance.
If I have the privilege of being backstage and listening to this wonderful conversation going on, and seeing, you know, how they wipe their brow and whatever they're doing, I find that much more interesting to me than the performance pictures.
This show includes nine of Leonard's works, including one where Dizzy Gillespie jubilantly hoists his trumpet in the air. Gillespie's daughter, jazz vocalist Jeannie Bryson, says this picture captures her father's essence.
It's very joyous. It's very playful. His body language was so great in it. He was a very physical person. My mom claims that he could squat down like a Russian dancer with one leg out, like in a crouch, and then get back up again. And this has a lot of motion and movement in it, even though, of course, it's a still photograph. It kind of shows you how he moved.
Photographs that show the motion and emotion of music and those who make it were also what Mattis was looking for, as she poured first through the Eastman House collection, then through photos at the studios of the artists or their estates.
For example, Philip Halsman. The ones that I selected for this exhibition included a fabulous image of Louis Armstrong. In that image, you see Louis Armstrong's amazing bug eyes, and you see him playing the trumpet, but you don't see the full trumpet. You just see the mouthpiece, and you see some of the saliva coming down his chin, and you see every pore in his face, and just this energy popping out of that image.
Other photographs include Edward Steichen's images of Irving Berlin and his family, and George Gershwin smoking a cigar. Frances Wolfe shows Ornette Coleman playing the violin backwards, an image Mattis says reflects a willingness to take risks.
And this is a perfect example of how American music is about breaking barriers, breaking rules.
While visitors look at the images, a compilation of music created or performed by those represented plays in the gallery. A photography exhibition about music wouldn't be complete without, well, music. Or would it?
That was actually a big question. What music, if any, to play during the show? It's actually quite a thorny problem. In a way, I would prefer to have the show with no music at all, because we all carry our own soundtracks around in our heads.
Can a photograph sing? Maybe not out loud, but for many music lovers, looking at a photograph can be more than a visual experience. If you've heard the music at a club in the 40s or in a state-of-the-art concert hall, on your home record player, or through earbuds connected to the latest technology, the right photograph of a musical master can bring it all back.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Gershwin to Gillespie, Portraits in American Music is at the James A. Michener Art Museum's New Hope location. It runs through October 7th. A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art examines the work of three German artists working in the second half of the 20th century. Kiefer, Polk and Richter is the third installment of the museum's notation series of rotating projects that explore various approaches to contemporary art. The show includes works by Anselm Kiefer, Sigmar Polke and Gerhard Richter from the museum's collection, as well as loans from private and other collections in the area. I recently took a walk through the exhibition with the museum's curator of contemporary art, Carlos Bosualdo. Besides their nationality and the time period they lived and live in, what else ties these three German 20th century artists together?
Well, you know, both Sigmar Polke and Gerhard Richter, they were working together very closely at the beginning of their careers, and they were part of what, with Conrad Fischer, or something called capitalist realism. Capitalist realism was some sort of response to pop, which was the dominant movement at the time in the 60s. And so it was their way of coping with the realities of Western Germany and the West in general. Kiefer comes a little bit later in the picture, and he was never close, that I know, to Polke and Richter in the way they were really working together. They were
Went to school together.
Yes, and for a period of time they were really, you know, experimenting with similar themes, and Kiefer from the beginning was very obviously coming after them and learning. He had learned from their experiences, but he shared with them an interest in painting, and that's something that now that there's so many younger people that are, you know, very interested in painting again, and the art world seems to be receptive to that, seems kind of obvious. But the truth is that in the 70s, when the art world started to be more and more dominated by conceptual practices, to have practices that were consistently about painting was kind of an exception. And I think that's what gathered these three people together. They were working with some, you know, they share some similar concerns, but in terms of their relationship with certain imagery, the form, the dimensions of their work, the exploration of the medium, but mostly it is, you know, this concern with the possibilities of painting after, you know, conceptual art, after pop art, that it gathers them together.
Were they actively rebelling against the idea of high-minded art, of art for the brain rather than art for the soul and for the heart?
I think that they also want to be very eloquent, and they want to talk about history. I mean, the three of them are very concerned about history, and how could not they be working and living in Germany after the war? I mean, but they dealt with history in very different ways.
But it has to be also said that the work that they produced is very beautiful, very aesthetically pleasing.
It is very beautiful. I think that the interesting thing is that they sort of arrive at beauty. I mean, I think it's not an expected beauty. In some cases, it's a completely unexpected beauty. Like Polke is a good example. I mean, he uses colors that are not beautiful per se in some of the pieces, but they suddenly become kind of amazing. He sort of makes the image emerge in front of your eyes, and that captures you, and that's what we call beauty.
Philadelphia Museum of Art curator of contemporary art, Carlos Basualdo. Kiefer, Polka, and Richter runs through November 25th. Look over a list of job titles in theatre, and mostly you won't have difficulty working out what people do. Actors act, directors direct, set designers design sets, stage managers manage a stage, etc. But scroll down the list of theatre professionals to dramaturg, and unless you're in the know or in the business, you could well be scratching your head. So now, as part of his continuing series on what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer sets about exploring the role or even multiple roles of the dramaturg.
Not every theatre company or theatre production has an official dramaturg, but the work of a dramaturg is used in nearly every show. Even so, it's one of the least understood positions in theatre. Wilma Theatre dramaturg Walter Bilderbach says the exact function of the role is tough to pin down.
It's a profession where I think everyone who does it would probably have their own definition that sort of coincides either with what it is they do or what it is they'd like to be doing. I've been doing it for a long time, and the job has varied slightly with each theater and with each director I've worked with.
Dramaturgy traces back to 18th century German writer and philosopher Gotthold Lessing. He wrote a collection of theoretical and critical essays about theater, which came to be known as the Hamburg Dramaturgy. Since the time of Lessing, different forms of dramaturgy have been practiced in Europe, but it wasn't until the 1960s that the role started to emerge in the United States, when the not-for-profit regional theater system took off. One way to look at the modern dramaturg is as a facilitator. They support the work of others, such as the director, the designer, or the playwright. This work can look different from theater to theater. For instance, in a company that does mostly established works, a dramaturg does a lot of research. He or she is the resident historian, investigating the political, philosophical, and cultural context of a play and its playwright, explaining the meanings of phrases and references in a script. Basically, making sure that everyone involved knows what the play is about in depth.
I've seen this tracking shot. I mean, he's taking in this whole world. I mean, the way right. The mise-en-scène that he's created. And
Philadelphia Theatre Company dramaturg Warren Hoffman often spends time with actors and directors during the first days of rehearsals to go over this type of material, to answer questions, and alongside the director to observe the process. Hoffman says that most good directors are and should be dramaturgs, too.
Anytime you're working on a script and trying to answer questions about it, make it better, you're doing dramaturgy. But most regional theaters have someone who's dedicated to this role.
And by most regional theaters, Hoffman means the nonprofit theaters outside of the Broadway, New York commercial theater circuit. In the larger companies with a full season of demanding works and many responsibilities, a lot of directors and artistic directors don't have the time to dedicate to extensive dramaturgical work. Especially in a theater that produces a lot of new plays, a dramaturg commonly wears the hat of literary manager. This might involve helping to choose the season lineup, selecting the best translation, writing program notes, and leading after-show discussions. But it always means a lot of reading, according to Warren Hoffman.
Like many regional companies, we get approximately 300 plays sent to us over the course of a year, mainly from agents, sometimes submitted by local playwrights. And it's my job, in addition to our producing artistic director, to interns, to read through those scripts and to decide what we want to produce. Only about 10% of those plays do we even have an interest in, and if we're lucky, maybe 1% of what's actually submitted to us will actually get produced.
If a playwright is around, Hoffman says dramaturgs like himself can work with the author to help bring more clarity to a script, asking questions, offering suggestions, advice, and support. If the playwright is not around, dramaturgs are often described as advocates for the playwright and their intentions for the play. But while an advocate for or defender of the text is a common metaphor used to describe dramaturgy, University of Pennsylvania theater professor and dramaturg Carrie Mazur thinks that the explanation is misleading.
What the dramaturg is, if the dramaturg is an advocate of anything, is a defender of the work of art that's being made. If you're working with a playwright, then you're helping the playwright tell the story the playwright wants to tell and trying to stay true to that playwright's vision and aesthetics. If you're working with a director with a pre-existing dramatic text, the last thing that you have a loyalty to is to the script and the playwright. Your job is not to defend what that play has become in the past, but what this bunch of artists want to do with it right now.
Mazur explains that helping a theater group tell the best story possible often means provoking dialogue. Though never adversarial, it means asking a lot of tough, pesky questions. This role earns dramaturgs the label of in-house critic. But while a dramaturg might have input into many different aspects of a theater, Michelle Volansky, Washington College theater professor and former president of the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas, says a dramaturg can't claim ownership of much. One reason many find they're not cut out for the role.
In order to do this job, you have to remember a sense of humility. And you don't get to make the final decision about anything. You can agitate, you can advocate, you can do a lot of dances to try and get a play produced. But at the end of the day, the artistic director picks the plays, the director is directing the plays, the playwright is writing the play. And so the task of being another set of eyes in the room is a lot of people just can't handle it. There's an ego or two involved in theater. I'm not sure if you're aware of this. And sometimes they get huge. And if it becomes about the dramaturg, then something is very, very flawed.
Indeed, while dramaturgs provide vital resources for theater pieces, the Wilma Theater's Walter Bilderback says that accolades for dramaturgy are usually not a good thing.
A sign of success for me is really usually that the work is relatively invisible to an audience, that the director's work is better but looks like the director, that the playwright's work is better but looks like the playwright, that the actors, etc., etc.
With over 25 years of experience as a dramaturg, Bilderback says the profession has greatly expanded over the time of his career. He notes he doesn't need to explain his job to people as much as he did a few decades ago.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Paul Marotta and Elizabeth Flynn. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.